The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something. And what it is about.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
Of course, there's a different way.
Hi, welcome to the Mirror Football Podcast with me, Simon Head. Joining us on this week's show, Simon Bird talks to us about the St James's Park naming rights issue. Matty Lawrence, Gillingham centre-half, tells us about life in League Two. And Martin Lipton and John Cross give us the lowdown on England's upcoming game against Spain at Wembley. Right, joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast is Simon Bird from the Daily Mirror. Now, Simon, you cover the North East, and St James's Park, obviously, is the centre of attention right now. They've just renamed the stadium to the Sports Direct Arena, and the likes of Steve Harmison, Joey Barton, Danny Baker and Anton Deck have been online to express their dismay at the decision. What's the reaction been like up there from the fans?
The majority of the reaction is of anger and dismay that the club is selling, effectively selling 119 years of history, putting a price on, you know, on the traditions that the club have got in playing at that ground since 1892. There's quite an angry reaction. There are a few fans who sort of are putting a bit of trust in the club and are understanding why they're doing it in terms of trying to raise £10 million a year. But I think the majority is of disappointment and anger.
So you talk about £10 million a year. This name change that's actually just happened this week, how much is that earning the club right now?
Well, it's earning Newcastle get absolutely nothing from calling it St James's Park. I mean, it's an untapped income stream. That's the technical term the club are saying. Other clubs have done it. You know, in the past, Chelsea are trying to sell a naming right to Stamford Bridge. Sunderland and Spurs could well follow suit if the right deal came up. You look at Arsenal, who have built a new ground and called it the Emirates, Man City, the Etihad Stadium. Both new grounds, so it's slightly different to St James's Park. Newcastle get nothing at the moment. So this would be £10 million of new money. They're trying to combine the deal with a shirt sponsorship deal, which is up for grabs this summer. And put the two together into a sort of weighty package, which would be decent for a sort of a global, very well known company. We don't know whether the £10 million estimate is right yet because they haven't got a deal on the table. It might be less than that, might be more than that, but they're hoping for £10 million. You know, and they're saying this could mean the difference between buying a very good player for each season in the next 4 or 5 years or not buying a good player, or if the money's put to keeping season ticket prices down at the club. And they've done some very good deals this season for season tickets for fans. So that's the, you know, as I said in my piece this morning, it's tradition versus turnover. Do you want to go along sentimental, traditional route and say St James's Park should be preserved as St James's Park? Or do you say, okay, there's a ruthless businessman in Mike Ashley in charge here. He should be allowed to generate revenue as he sees fit, including, you know, the last slice of sort of history at the club, and that's the name of the stadium.
Right, and just to clarify, with the name change, with the Sports Direct Arena, are Sports Direct through Mike Ashley putting £10 million into the club, or is this almost like a gesture, almost advertising the fact that there are naming rights up for grabs?
Yeah, I see what we're getting at. Yeah, the Sports Direct are not paying for the honour of being of having their name, the stadium being named the Sports Direct Arena for this season. They're doing it to showcase what is available to, you know, to companies who they're going to negotiate with until the end of December to strike this deal. So, no, Newcastle will not be getting money from Sports Direct. That's not happening. And a lot of people are upset about that, saying that's not really quite right. But it's a showcasing thing, really. And I think also it's to get the flack that's happening now out of the way. I'm sure there's a plan in place at Newcastle to get this renamed now, the Sports Direct Arena, so that when a new brand takes it on, you know, they won't have a similar backlash against the new brand who are actually paying for the privilege.
Right, OK. And who's actually going to use this new name other than the club itself? I mean, for example, you as a journalist, when you're compiling your match reports, are you going to be duty-bound to call it by its new name, or are you still going to be referring to it as St James's Park?
Well, I think, I'll be a creature of habit and tradition and call it St James's Park, because that's what it'll be. I went there, you know, to watch games when I was a kid, like, you know, generations of people up in the northeast have done so. So I will call it St James's Park. I think the problem will come where you have rights holders like the BBC who pay for you know, match of the day and commentary rights and that kind of thing. I think they will probably be duty bound to call it the new name, Sports Direct Arena. As journalists, we've probably got a bit more leeway, and we can probably still call it St James's Park. I would personally like to still call it St James's Park. I think all the fans will. I don't think people will be saying, "Come on, let's hurry up and finish this pint. We're off to the Sports Direct Arena this afternoon." It just won't happen. These rebranding of stadia, you know, for the name to seep into public consciousness, it takes a long, long time, and it's not going to happen in the next 6 months.
No, sure, and obviously, as you say, it is a different situation compared to something like the Emirates, which was a new stadium. The name came with the stadium, and you know, there was an understanding that a lot of the money that came through that deal helped fund the stadium in the first place. This is quite different, isn't it? So
exactly, and if you look at comparable stadiums like Anfield and Old Trafford, those two stadia, which are famous old names in the history of English football, they've not been touched by their clubs. Now, you could say, what's the worst crime? That, you know, at Man United, the Glazers are milking the club for, you know, tens of millions of pounds in interest payments. Is that a worse crime than Mike actually renaming St James's Park? I mean, you could argue that actually it is, you know. But they haven't touched the Old Trafford name, but they have sold, you know, even Man United have even got a £40 million deal for the, you know, the training kit, for the rights to sponsor the training kit for domestic matches with DHL. It's huge business, and I think Newcastle have looked at the money other clubs are making through sponsorship and thought, we're absolutely not in that league. The Northern Rock deal, which is coming to an end, Newcastle were getting a maximum of £2.5 million a year for that. Absolute peanuts compared with the £23.5 million that Nike pay Man United for the shirt sponsorship deal. So, you know, there's big revenues which Newcastle are untapped for Newcastle, and that's what they're trying to do. But it's coming at a big price. It's coming at the price of goodwill and a positive mood on Tyneside that had been generated by the really good start to the season.
Well, that was my next point. I mean, is there an element of trying to bury the news in the fact that, you know, there's been a good start to the season from Newcastle, or has it been seen as things are going well, third in the league, just one point behind Manchester United, and now's the time to start to sell to try and sell the football club to a prospective sponsor?
That's a good point. I mean, you know, Newcastle, it has been, we've said frequently this season, it's too quiet, something's going to go wrong soon. And it's true enough, 11 games in, and there's this controversy off the pitch. I think there is an element of the regime thinking now, look, we're in a really strong position. All the decisions we've made recently have gone right. Appointed the right manager, they've bought the right players, and it's all looking good on the pitch. This unpopular decision, the good times now will help them get through this, they think, this unpopular decision that they've made. But it does upset, you know, the fans off the pitch. Whether it'll have an impact on the pitch, or I don't think it'll have an impact on the way the fans actually turn up at St James's Park, there we go again, and support the team. I think they'll be as noisy and vociferous and, you know, behind Alan Pardew and his men as they ever have been. So Geordies do distinguish between these two things, the off-field problems and actually getting behind their team at the stadium.
And obviously when Alan Pardew took over, he wasn't universally the most popular appointment at St James's Park. How have the fans sort of warmed to him now? Obviously they've had a fantastic start to the season, and things are looking good on the pitch, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a poll in our sister paper, the Evening Chronicle up here, showed 2% support for Alan Pardew's appointment when it was initially
the only way he's up then.
They're running a new one. I think the results are out tomorrow, and I think it'll be pretty much 90-100% approval ratings for Mr. Pardew. So he's certainly turned around the mood and the attitude towards him. And I suppose this is another thing the regime will hope that they've done controversial things which have turned out right. They can say, we're making correct decisions now. You'll be behind this in a year's time when we've got £40 million extra coming into the club. But yeah, on the pitch they've done really, really well. They've surprised everybody. Pretty much all the signings they've made in the summer have come off. They've lowered the age of the team from 27 point something or other to 25. So they're really looking younger and more hungry now. And they're working so hard for each other. That's the secret. You know, the teams can't play their normal game against Newcastle, because their defensive line is very good, but it comes from all 11 players pressing at the right time and squeezing the space from the opposition.
He certainly seems to have organised the team well, and it's great to see an English manager right up there in the sharp end of the Premier League. I mean, how long before we start hearing Pardew for England stories?
It's already happened. The last press conference we had with Alan Pardew, he was actually asked, I think TalkSport did a debate on who should be the next England manager, and ludicrously, in my opinion, it was put to Pardew, you know, after 11 really good games, are you a contender for the England job? He immediately said, don't be silly, there's only one man for it, it's Harry Redknapp, and he said he didn't have the experience for the England job. But it is good to see an England manager succeeding, because there's not many of them around, and, you know, if he launches Newcastle on a long-term 10-year, even 5 or 6 year route to the top, where they're challenging in the top 6 or 7, then Alan Pardew will be an England manager one day, maybe in 6 or 7 years' time, but certainly not yet.
And looking slightly shorter term than the 5 or 6 years, could we be seeing European football at the Sports Direct Arena, St James's Park, whatever you want to call it, next season?
It's an outside shot. I mean, Newcastle have played well so far. Everything's gone for them. They've had very few injuries. They've got a tough run of games coming up now against Man United, and Chelsea, which will be a huge test. You've got to get in the top six to guarantee Europe. Fifth and sixth usually get a UEFA Cup place, possibly seventh, depending on whoever wins or is in the final of the Carling Cup. I think Newcastle could get seventh with a fair wind. That's possible. Top six is difficult, because you're trying to oust a club like Liverpool or Arsenal or Tottenham, and they have got much bigger firepower in their squads than Newcastle have. Seventh place is the realistic top target, I think, this year. And if European football comes with that, then that would be fantastic. But then it would also test their squad next year, but that's a problem we'd be happy to have.
Well, they've certainly had a great start to the season. It'll be interesting to see how they go. Simon, thanks very much for joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast. Okay, joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast now is Gillingham centre-half and a man who spent the last week wrestling with a washing machine, being beaten up by an osteopath and being involved in a 7-goal thriller at Priestfield. It's Matty Lawrence. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, not bad at all. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Now, you've been doing a column for us on the Mirror Football website, 20,000 Leagues Under the Premier. Was that your title?
That was definitely not my title, no. I think we're only about 3 or 4 leagues under the Premier. But yeah, that's fine. 20,000 is more than fine. Probably £20,000 a week is about right under the Premier Division.
And how have you found life in League Two? Obviously, you've played your trade most of the time up in the Championship level. How have you found it down in League Two?
Yeah, it's been different. It's tough mentally sometimes going to, you know, without being too derogatory, going to the likes of Accrington and Morecambe and places like that, and Aldershot maybe, when there's, you know, 1,500 people, 2,000 people. Not that I went to Old Trafford, you know, regularly in places like that, but I was used to, you know, been used to playing in front of crowds of 20,000, 25,000, 30,000. So it's tough getting used to hearing each individual shout and being ridiculed by one man and his dog. Yeah, it's tough, but it's been fun so far.
Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you've given a little bit back? Because obviously, as you just said, you could probably pick out the individuals giving you the stick.
You try not to, but I'm sure every now and again, yeah, I'll give a little bit back. I'm sure if someone's willing to give it out, then they should be able to receive a little bit as well. But no, nothing too harsh, and certainly not swearing, hopefully.
And you're one of the more senior players down there at Priestfield at Gillingham. Do you find that being in League Two, there's probably less coaching staff than you might get at a Championship or a League One club? Do you find you're more involved in the running of the team, maybe a bit more involved in the coaching drills and things like that, or are you still just another one of the players?
No, I'm definitely still one of the players. I don't get involved in coaching drills. I don't get involved in you know, any kind of team selection or anything like that. I feel like I've probably got a better rapport with our gaffer, with Andy Hessenthal, than I have had with other managers. But then that is more because of age, I guess. You know, I'm much more similar in age to his age than I am maybe, you know, some of the other lads on the team who are 17, 18, 19 years old. So, yeah, as I say, I have a great rapport with the gaffer. And we talk about the team, we talk about football, but yeah, I certainly have no influence on anything, and I certainly don't get involved in any drills, but I'd like to hope that the players, some of the younger players, look up to me. Maybe not in terms of, I'm not somebody who's given advice left, right and centre, but I hope they take note of how I go about things every day and how I look after myself, look after my body, and, you know, do work around the gym and things like that before and after training. I hope that rubs off on other people.
And how is the squad down there at Gillingham? You're ninth in League Two at the moment. Do you think you've got a squad capable of pushing for promotion? There's been a lot of talk about promotion at Gillingham pre-season and leading into the season. It's been a bit of an up and down start so far.
Yeah, we've certainly been very Jekyll and Hyde so far. Without a shadow of a doubt, we've got one of the best squads and probably one of the best teams on paper in the league. You know, if not the best team, the best squad. But things don't always pan out like that, and on paper's no good. You have to perform at the best levels, at the highest levels every week. So we're not 100% happy with where we are in the league. Obviously, we want to be up in the playoff places or in the automatic promotion places. But yeah, we're not on a down or anything like that. We're just sort of keeping on with what we're doing, and hopefully we can string a run of results together. As I say, we've been winning games, losing games, winning games, losing games. That's not always the best way to go. We want to start being unbeatable in a way. We want to start winning games, drawing games, and not losing too many.
And how have you found the actual football itself as a comparison with the Championship? Is it a different style of football? Is it more physically demanding on you?
No, I don't think it's more physically demanding in any way. The Championship's a tough league. Some people often, call the Championship the hardest league to get out of, sort of thing. And people say it's whatever the fifth best league in Europe, behind obviously La Liga, the Premier Division, and the Italian and the German leagues. That's a really, really tough league. Here, Division Two, it's, I guess some teams like to try and play football, but the qualities are obviously not there the same as it is in the Championship. But it is it's tough. Every week's tough, as I say, often more mentally rather than physically.
And looking up at the Premier League, you've got this issue with Carlos Tevez at Manchester City. He's recently just no-showed for training, and obviously there's a big falling out there between him and the club somewhere along the line. What would be the attitude at Priestfield if someone decided they weren't going to pitch up for training?
Yeah, it wouldn't go down very well, but I'm sure it doesn't go down too well at Manchester City either. It's tough to comment on that situation. I don't know the ins and outs of it too much, but yeah, if someone doesn't turn up to training, that's obviously a big no-no. If you know, we're all in it together, especially, as you say, probably more so down at our level. We've only got a squad of, probably 14 to 18 players that you'd actually want to be starting in your first team, whereas Man City can probably call on 40, 45 people. So it's down at our level. We really are all in it together, sort of thing.
And for you personally, going through a working week, if you like, getting yourself ready for games, it sounds like quite an arduous process from reading your column, trips to the osteopath and such like. Take us through that. I mean, how often do you do that? And what exactly is he doing to you to put you through this much pain? And are you getting a benefit from it?
I'm definitely getting a benefit from it. And I see an osteopath up in Hampstead probably once a month, maybe at certain times when the games are coming more thick and fast. I'll probably see him a couple of times a month. It's somebody I've seen ever since I had double hernia surgery when I was at Palace, probably 4 or 5 years ago now. And he's just somebody who corrects my posture a bit more and just sorts out the general aches and pains of the lower limbs, of specifically the hamstrings and sort of my pelvic region here. He sorts that out. I can literally be almost hobbling down to see him on a Wednesday, and then when I'm out of seeing him after an hour or so, I certainly notice a difference. I'm walking a lot more freely, and yeah, as I say, he corrects my posture to a certain degree. So yeah, it's something that I've done, as I say, religiously for 5 or 6 years now, and I'll carry on doing it until I stop playing.
And just to finish off with, in your most recent column, you were talking about Movember.
was slightly tongue-in-cheek.
is anyone in at the club actually doing this? Are we going to see any tashies on the pitch?
I'm not sure they are. No, in fact, none of them are. The closest to home I've got is my brother-in-law sporting a quite decent handlebar moustache, but that's as close as I've got. No one at the club's doing it.
All right, well, we'll finish up on that. Thanks very much for joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast.
No worries, take care, son.
Okay, joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast is the Daily Mirror's Martin Lipton as we look ahead to England v Spain at Wembley this Saturday. It's a 5:15 kick-off, and it's an interesting-looking squad from England. How's Fabio Capello going to approach this, Martin? It's kind of a sort of two options ahead of him. Is he going to field his strongest possible side and give him a test, or is he going to look to bring some of his younger players through? He's got a lot of players who graduated from the under-21s.
Well, it's clearly going to be an experimental side. That's a decision that's been taken. Obviously, he left out Wayne Rooney, looking at options ahead of the Euros, because, as we know, Rooney will miss, at the moment, the first three games, certainly at best the first two. He's not going to play John Terry, even though he's in the squad, despite the Anton Ferdinand round. We're missing players of the calibre of Gerrard and Wilshere. So, of necessity, by what he's done and what he said already, we know it will be experimental. It looks that Phil Jones, for example, will play in midfield rather than the centre-half. He can have a look at people like Kyle Walker, potentially, Danny Welbeck, maybe Daniel Sturridge. So he's looking to try to find some alternatives to his normal team to ascertain whether these players are going to be good enough to be genuine contenders for the squad for the Euros, which in itself makes a lot of sense. But then you get playing against the best team on the planet, and there's the danger it could all go pretty nastily wrong, and that is a risk that Capello is taking by opting for this particular approach in the game. It could be quite a difficult encounter for a lot of these young players. And as we know, when England get beat badly, there tends to be a fairly nasty backlash from the punters, from across up and down the country. And there is that risk and danger for those players being scarred by the experience, when you were hoping they might go in with a little bit of that innocence and naivety, which might allow them to play with a bit more freedom come the finals in Poland and Ukraine next summer.
It is such a big spectacle, isn't it? It's a sellout at Wembley. It's the world champions coming to play. And they've brought a very, very strong squad with them. And there's 10 former under-21 internationals for England in this squad. Jack Rodwell's obviously been called in, could potentially make his full debut. Is this a sign that Capello's looking to bring a new generation of players in, or is it just a victim of circumstance with other players unavailable, do you think?
No, I think it's more about Capello having a view that too many of the players who've been established players are still hurt and scarred by their experiences of the past, and that he feels that one or two of them who've been members of his squad, pretty much key members of his squad, would just be doomed to repeat the failures of the past at tournament level. And he's looking to try to bring in people with a freshness and vitality that might just change that that pattern of tournament end game, which we've all become far too used to. In that respect, I don't have a problem with this. I do know from what Capello has said that if it were down to him, we wouldn't be playing Spain in this game. Yeah. He would prefer to be playing two slightly lower calibre teams. But we are playing Spain. That's what it is. The Sweden game on Tuesday, again, will probably be a fairer test of the players, because we might even see the ball. I'm not too sure how much of the ball we'll see on Saturday.
Yeah, and you mentioned John Terry and the fact that it's been said that he's not going to be involved in this game. With the news of Phil Jagielka's broken toe, and there's talk of whether he'll be given a painkilling injection so he can play, there are rumblings that Terry might still be called upon for this game. How likely is that possibility? And if he was to be involved at Wembley on Saturday, what do you think the crowd reaction would be if John Terry walked out with the England team on Saturday?
I think the crowd reaction would be more supportive than people might think, actually. I mean, a lot of the England fans do have a lot of time for John Terry, and understandably so. Look at his record as captain. England win more games when John Terry is captain, percentage-wise, than they have under any other previous captain. He's quite an important figure in that respect. But I don't think he'll play. I think that unless it's absolutely impossible for Jagielka to play, which it clearly isn't because he's been playing for Everton with this injury, that Jagielka will play alongside Lescott, that Cahill will be on the bench, and Terry won't. And Terry will be involved against Sweden, but I think will be 80% unlikely to be involved against Spain.
And you mentioned the situation with Phil Jones. Obviously, a serious talent for Manchester United and for England coming through. He can play centre-half, he can play midfield. You've mentioned that there might be a midfield role for him. Do you think he's going to be given a man-marking job on someone like Iniesta or Xavi? Or how do you see him fitting into this team on Saturday?
I don't think England are capable of man-marking. It's not what English players are adept at. They're not used to it, they're not comfortable with it. And if you're playing a player in an alien role, asking him to do an even more alien job would be, I would say, madness to the point of lunacy, really. So I can't see that. But I think his role will be to disrupt, to distract them, to get in and amongst them, hustle and harry, and stop them getting the passing momentum going. He's got some energy, Jones, we've seen that. And what he also has got when he gets the ball to feet, which may be two or three times rather than the sort of 15 or 20 he gets in United, is that he will drive the ball forward and could cause Spain some problems. I mean, let's be fair, if Spain playing, that Spain will win, they're better than England. And they will want to win, no question about that. But, if Jones and Coke and probably Scott Parker and I would guess Frank Lampard, that would be my likely midfield three, that sort, can get in and about Spain and make it hard for them, then England can get a lot out of this, particularly if they, were to get some positives in terms of creating chances. Irrespective of the result, if England lose 1 or 2 nil but play quite well, they'll get far more from that, perhaps, than they will do from playing Sweden on Tuesday.
Definitely. It's such a steep learning curve for some of the players that are going to be brought in. Just to finish off, what would represent a good day's work for these England players? You mentioned the result might possibly be beyond us with the level of opposition we're up against. What would represent a good result for Fabio Capello? What's he looking for?
For me, the final result is irrelevant, as long as you don't get humped 5 or 6, which I don't think would happen. I think if you have a match and you finish the game thinking England have been really competitive today, they've made Spain work really hard. They've created chances. They've looked as if they knew what they were doing. They've looked at home against Spain, even if they were to lose 2-0. I think that would be a really, really positive afternoon's work because it isn't England's first team. It's a team without Terry, without Gerrard, without Wilshere, without Rooney, all of whom are first team players. Of course, if we then have to play Spain in the opening game of the qualifiers, it wouldn't look so good, perhaps. But I think the finals, rather, in Poland. But I think just showing the ability to be competitive would be a massive plus for not just the players involved, but for Capello and also for the fans at home to start to think that maybe we're not that bad after all.
And the match kicks off at 5:15 on Saturday. You'll be able to read reports and reaction from Martin and the rest of the Daily Mirror team on mirrorfootball.co.uk. Martin, thanks very much for joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast.
No trouble at all.
Joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast is the Daily Mirror's John Cross. How are you, John?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Right, England this weekend, obviously, taking on Spain at Wembley, 5:15 kickoff. Huge task for Fabio Capello's men. There's been a big build-up to this game for matters off the pitch. Obviously, football takes time this weekend to remember those servicemen and women that we lost in battle on Remembrance Day. And there's been a big hoo-ha over the issue of the poppy and whether we could have it on the England shirts. You've written about it on Mirror Football yourself. FIFA have come out and given a bit of a compromise decision. The England players are now allowed to wear their poppies on their armbands on Saturday. What's your take on it?
I think it's a shame that the shirts haven't been allowed, really. I don't think it's a political statement at all. And I just think it's just a mark of respect and remembrance to our brave heroes, really. There's no political message in there at all for me. So I'm pleased that FIFA has seen sense and perhaps come to some sort of compromise. And I do think it's a good way around it. It was put forward a few times. I've been tweeting away about it as well. And a few people actually replied and suggested it. And so I do think it's a good idea, one that shouldn't sort of compromise things for FIFA in the future. And it's a good way around it. I do sympathise with their difficulty. They don't want political statements on football shirts which is fair enough. But I just think that this is such a special case. I think if any other country in the world had sort of, you know, been through and has a similar campaign, then I would fully support what they intend to do as well. And I think it's quite good that the whole nation, including the Prime Minister and even the Royals, have become involved and shown the depth of feeling is indeed supported.
It's been a strange one, isn't it? Because obviously Remembrance Day has been going for a very long time. 93 years since the end of World War One, which is what started Remembrance Day. And we've never had this debate over the England shirt before. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we should have. And, you know, as you say, it's a regular international fixture in November around this time. So while I think, you know, it's strange that it's not happened before, I think maybe in recent times, I think the poppy has been given a new meaning, I think, by current conflicts and when people see the losses that sort of our soldiers have now in conflicts going on still around the world. I think that kind of brings it home with a poignant message and something that should still be remembered and respected. And I think it's never been more as important now than it has been in the past. And I don't think sometimes, I think, you know, this argument, I don't really think it washes, you know, why is it suddenly important now? I think if we've made a mistake in the past by ignoring it, I think it's high time we began to respect it again. I think it's great that football has embraced it and seen it for what it is. And, you know, I always wear my poppy with pride, and I'm sure the players feel exactly the same. And the players that have spoken today have both, Phil Jones and Joe Hart, said similar.
And the Royal British Legion have come out in the press and said that the support they've had from the Football Association has been top draw. And there's a whole load of different ways that the FA and the England team are going to be paying tribute. On the day, there'll be a huge poppy on the pitch. The team will be wearing poppies on their training kit. You know, the FA have really embraced this, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I think they're in a difficult situation with the clamour for it. I think they knew what the FIFA rules were, and they played a sort of a difficult game, if you like. But they finally found a solution. So I think you know, FIFA deserve credit, as do the FA for how can I put it, bending the rules slightly and certainly finding a good compromise that I think won't jeopardise rules in future, but at the same time realise the importance of our poppy and what it means for us.
And as I say, I mean, you know, the most important thing, of course, is the actual remembrance itself. And I believe there'll be a 2-minute silence before kickoff, which I'm sure will be impeccably observed by full house at Wembley Stadium. It should be a real occasion to sort of showcase that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's important. I think that fans sort of take notice of that, really. I don't think it's anything about nationalism or sort of jingoism or anything like that, or glamorising war. I just think it's a mark of respect for people. And I think people who can't see it like that, well, I just, you know, sort of... feel a little bit sorry for them, really. It's not anything else than, I think, a mark of respect for a lot of people. And sometimes I think in the modern society that we live in, I think people would rather have a row about it than perhaps find something a good, sensible compromise.
Agreed. Moving on to the actual game itself, Spain have named a very, very strong looking squad. England's squad have got a lot of experienced players missing, and it's got quite a youthful feel to it. There's about 10 members of the old under-21 side have been drafted in over the course of the last few months or whatever. We've got a big core of players who look like they're being brought through by Fabio Capello. It's a big task for England, this. What can they get from this game, and can they beat Spain, and if so, how?
Well, I don't think they will beat Spain. I think I fancy Spain quite strongly, but I think they're an outstanding team. They're the best team, you know, certainly that I can see. I've seen at international level, fantastic European champions, world champions, and they do look outstanding in every department, particularly going forward and in midfield. And I think England will have their work cut out. I think the test for England really is to see what sort of level they're at. I think it might be an eye-opener for some. I think there's an opportunity to try some players, look at different options. We know that Wayne Rooney's suspended for 3 games, possibly less on appeal, you never know. But then they have to find different alternatives for him to kind of step in and work around that. So it gives an opportunity, I feel, for the likes of Darren Bent up front, Danny Welbeck, Danny Sturridge, and on the left, Stuart Downing, Adam Johnson. So there's opportunities there. I think the most exciting thing is perhaps sort of different formations, different versions up front, really, of things, how they're working. There's even been talk of Phil Jones in midfield, so that'll be a huge test to try and contain the Spanish midfield, which contains certainly some of the best players in the world.
And it could potentially be a big day for Jack Rodwell, who's been brought into the squad. He's someone who could get a run out in this game. On his, and what a baptism it would be against the world champions in front of a full house at Wembley.
Yeah, it would be, definitely. I do think a lot of those players, I'm thinking sort of Jack Rodwell and sort of Kyle Walker, still sort of, you know, very much in their infancy. For Rodwell, it's his first call-up, so it's a good chance for him, either against Spain or indeed against Sweden. So you'd like to think that they'll be given that test in either of those two games, just to see what they can do, and also to sample a kind of a big match atmosphere and expectations for the Wembley crowd, because it can be a demanding crowd, it can be a pressurised atmosphere, and I think it will set them up and give them a taste of what they can expect at the Euros, and let's see where they can handle it.
Now, Fabio Capello is due to leave his post as England manager after the Euros, and a couple of the comments that he made before England's last game sort of left a bit of a question mark hanging in the air to a degree. Do you think he might be reconsidering that, and that with all these young players coming through, he might be tempted to stay on?
I don't really think so. I can see why he's left that door open, but I still think that he'll go. I think people sort of get so many questions sometimes at them that he can give variations on the theme that leave you wondering what exactly their intentions are. But I think he's given assurances on a few occasions that this will be his last management job. I think that he will leave his post, and but then sort of maybe time to move on. Whether he'll move into club football is another matter. I think maybe some very, very lavish, rich clubs in Europe at the moment, so maybe they may be able to tempt him. I don't know, but I don't think he'll be in charge of England beyond Euro 2012.
Well, enjoy the game on Saturday, John. Thanks very much for joining us on the Mirror Football Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week. That was the Mirror Football Podcast. Thank you to Simon Bird, Matty Lawrence, Martin Lipson and John Cross. We'll be back next week on the Mirror Football Podcast.
The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something. And what it is about...
I am going to get 100% out of here.
Thank you for downloading this podcast, a Mirror Digital production. The Mirror Football Podcast theme music is the cunningly titled Football by the band Peers. That's P-E-E-R-S. Check them out at myspace.com/wearepeers. myspace.com/wearepeers.